You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 28th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio.
Russian President Vladimir Putin's hunt for anybody to blame but himself continues. The UK government's attempts to cut down immigration somehow inspire record immigration. And would you buy a $60 Bible from someone facing 91 indictments? I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Carol Walker and Ben Kelly will discuss the day's big stories, and our weekly letter from is a letter lamenting the increasingly snow-free French Alps. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Carol Walker, political commentator and Times radio presenter, boo, and by Ben Kelly, audience editor at Newsweek. Hello to you both.
Yeah, good evening.
Hello.
Do either of you, first of all, Carol, have any huge exciting plans for Easter, which I am reliably informed begins tomorrow?
I probably shouldn't mention them because I'm going to be appearing on another radio station, having been gadding all over the place for the last few weeks. I'm going to be around here and focusing on, well, some of the issues that we're going to be talking about this evening.
So basically, if people still want to hear more on these subjects after they've heard about them on Monocle Radio, Times Radio is there.
Well, obviously, our conversation is going to be so scintillating that they will be absolutely crying out for more, which they can always get on some other station.
Well, no pressure then. Ben, do you have any huge Easter plans, like, for example, appearing on, frankly, lesser radio networks?
No, I don't. I intend on being in front of the television, watching some classic movies, eating lots of chocolate. We were told this week not to eat an entire Easter egg all in one go. It's bad for your health, apparently, but I'll be taking that risk.
I was entranced by that particular bit of public health advice because it did make me wonder who were the people who until then were yamming Easter eggs by the fistful and thinking this is doing me a power of good.
Yeah, not me.
Well, you have that to look forward to. We will be starting in Russia and with President Vladimir Putin's lengthening list of people he is seeking to blame for last Friday's terrorist attack by Islamic State on a Moscow theatre. Instead of, for example, the intelligence services who ignored warnings relayed by the United States and who at any rate have lately been preoccupied at Putin's direction, helping to oversee the altogether unnecessary invasion of an entirely blameless neighbour. Among those on Putin's list are what a recent Russian Supreme Court judgment named as the International LGBT Social Movement, whose sympathies may well come as something of a surprise to Islamic State. Ben, first of all, in fairness to the FSB, not a sentence I ever thought I would utter, but I've just gone with it. Is it necessarily an intelligence failure when a terrorist attack occurs? In this country in particular, when people discuss this, they always come back to that remark of the IRAs that we only have to be lucky once, you have to be lucky every time.
Yeah, quite. I mean, you can have the best intelligence in the world, but these things can happen. And I think as we saw, you know, in recent years in London or other European countries where people used a car or a lorry as a weapon, you know, it just doesn't take much to escalate a situation. I think what's happened here is the FSB, you know, we've covered this as one of our lead stories on Newsweek today. And all the intelligence and experts we spoke to said, you know, the FSB have been entirely focused almost on Ukraine, pointing in that one direction, that they have not had their eye on other such threats. And of course, they've also been asked to monitor, as you say, so-called extremists like the LGBT movement, also listed Jehovah's Witnesses, Meta, anyone who has ever supported Navalny, etc. So they're not focused on the kind of things, these other threats that perhaps they should have been.
Carol, the crackdown on gay clubs, gay societies, the LGBT community in general, there would be an element of farce to it were it not so serious. This is having real-world impact on entirely blameless people. If you are Vladimir Putin, though, what political sense does it make to embark on this patently ridiculous crusade?
It does certainly have very serious repercussions. I mean, there have already been raids on gay clubs, people arrested for showing signs of affection with someone from the same sex out on the streets. And it is very much part of President Putin's increasingly authoritarian rule. And it does appear to be also part of this attempt to say to his people, look, there are enemies within. You have to watch out. And thus to justify the increasingly brutal powers that he has taken to crack down on, as Ben was outlining there, all kinds of different groups within the country. He clearly does not want to take the blame himself for what appears to be something of a lapse in security, which allowed this horrendous attack at the Crocus Hall, at least 137 mm-hmm. people killed. And it is really also, I think, part of his attempts just to blame everyone else and make sure that the blame doesn't land on him.
I mean, Ben, this is fairly stereotypical paranoid populist playbook stuff, but is it really going to stick? I mean, the fact that he's roping the Jehovah's Witnesses into this, I mean, sure, they're kind of annoying, but they're not a meaningful threat to the fabric of the Russian state, I don't think.
Well, it's very hard to know, of course, what people in Russia are actually believing when they hear, you know, President Putin. I was very surprised to read today that sort of, you know, anti-gay sentiments in polls had gone from sort of 19% who were against them 10 years ago to 60% today. Now, that's Russian polling. But obviously, he can take people on a certain journey if he continues this kind of rhetoric. But whether the average Russian who, you know, is not having a great time economically, you know, maybe dad or husband's been sent to Ukraine, so on, are really looking around them and thinking, oh, yeah, you know, it's the Jehovah's Witnesses. I'm not so sure. But we can never really know. It's kind of the age-old question with Russia, what the thought is on the ground.
Carol, as Ben was saying, there is a sense growing that part of the reason that perhaps the FSB and other security agencies were not paying as much attention to Islamic State as they might have been is that they are all massively focused on Ukraine. But this is not an exclusively Russian failing, is it? This is a tendency among governments to get incredibly tunnel visioned on one thing, often an entirely imaginary and unnecessary thing, and in so doing they forget actually important stuff.
Indeed, and Putin was very swift to try and point the finger at Ukraine, even though Ukraine has insisted it had nothing to do with it. And frankly, these claims that the perpetrators alleged of this attack were fleeing towards Ukraine seems a bit unlikely, since they would be presumably fleeing towards Russian front lines, which wouldn't seem to be a very sensible route to take. We've since then had the Belarusian president saying, well, actually, they were heading towards Belarus. And then the people who've been picked up and put in court, who may or may not have been involved in the attack, are actually from Tajikistan. And of course, the other aspect to all of this is that the Russian authorities and the FSB have also been very aware of the terrorist threat, for example, from Chechnya and from the Northern Caucasus. It is perhaps understandable that attackers may have got through. But I think what is really worrying is the way that so soon after this we got initially just one or two voices, and then senior figures in the Kremlin and from people like Medvedev suggesting that there should be the death penalty for terrorists. And whilst some people may then think, well, the sort of people who carry out this horrendous attack on a concert, that the death penalty might seem an attractive option. When you then look at the bracket of organisations that President Putin likes to put in that terrorist category, that is quite worrying, especially as they include now apparently something called the socialist LGBT movement, which presumably is a kind of catch-all phrase that could be used to cover all kinds of innocent people. Now, I'm not saying that he's trying to bring in the death penalty for people who go out on the streets with their boyfriend or girlfriend. But I think it is a further alarming indication of the increasingly authoritarian way in which President Putin runs his country.
Well, I can exclusively reveal that this Saturday's edition of the Foreign Desk will be looking at various of the fallout from that terrorist attack on Crocus Hall in Moscow. That goes out at midday UK time on Saturday. But moving along to the UK, where it is difficult to argue that the current Conservative government has had any kind of coherent theme. Five prime ministers in 8 years will do that. If there has been one consistent motif, however, it is an ardent desire to restrict immigration. Brexit, indeed, behind all the rhetorical guff about sovereignty, was effectively a referendum on immigration. Ironically, then, the current Conservative government has proved no good at all at restricting immigration. Net legal migration to the UK has recently reached all-time peaks, and so have less formal arrivals. So far, in 2024, 4,644 people are known to have arrived by dinghy across the English Channel, which is a first quarter record. Ben, why are they so bad at this?
It's very hard to tell. I'm sure they're wondering that
this
themselves.
This is not the only thing they're bad at, to be clear, but they are notably bad at this.
There may be something in that. I think it's a little bit like, it's kind of the word we were using in the first section, distraction. You know, I think the Tories have been distracted across this past term, whatever you want to call the past sort of 5-8 years, by Brexit, by other things, obviously COVID as well. And therefore, they didn't get a great deal of other things done. And something like immigration has just kind of fallen by the wayside as it has simultaneously been overtaking the country as a huge issue. They don't know how to tackle it. There's no one getting ahead of it. Anyone who does come up with an idea, I'm thinking of Braverman or whoever, is very extreme, is not really well liked in the party, etc. So there's no one bringing together a proper approach. Their Rwanda scheme, you know, not very popular. It's up against, you know, internal opposition, opposition from the actual opposition, the courts, etc. They don't have an answer. Does anyone have an answer? I'm not sure. I'm sure they're probably thinking, let's just get to the end of this term, and maybe it won't be our problem anymore.
Carol, do you think they've even been seriously trying? Do they perhaps at some level recognise the UK's economic dependence on immigration? I'm wondering about this. Well, I wondered about this especially around about 4 years ago, when this government of all governments had all the reason it would ever need to close all the borders and completely shut the country off. And I think the most ardent pro-immigration person would have thought, actually, you know what, in the circumstances, yeah, seems actually pretty reasonable. And they didn't do it then.
It does seem extraordinary that on the one hand we have this often pretty outspoken rhetoric against asylum seekers and people who come to the country illegally, whilst at the same time, as you say, figures for legal migration are at an all-time high. Mm-hmm. Now, there have been some steps to try to reduce the number of family dependents that people can bring into the country. That could bring the figures down a bit. But there's also been a complete lack of any strategic attempt to try to reduce the numbers of people coming here seeking asylum. If you look at a situation at the moment, you've got 95,000 people in the immediate backlog waiting for their asylum mm-hmm. applications to be determined.
This is an entire medium-sized town.
This is an entire and while they wait, they're here for several years. We've then had several instances where people, of course, after they've been here a certain amount of time, they simply disappear. If you're desperate to get to a country, if you know that there is a very good chance that you can find casual work in the UK, and you've got family members here already, it's a pretty good bet. You then look at the situation where actually, when they finally get round to dealing with the asylum cases, a majority, around 60%, actually get given asylum. So people think they've got a reasonably good chance, and they know they've got a good chance of having a few years here in any case. But instead of trying to actually tackle the backlog so that you can deal with cases quickly so that people who shouldn't be here can be removed or in some other way processed, they've put all their eggs in this Rwanda basket, which, for those who may not be aware of it, is this scheme to send illegal migrants to Rwanda. Not a single flight has taken off so far. It's only ever going to take a few hundred. And there's still a battle to try and get the legislation through to somehow declare Rwanda safe so that they can try and reduce the number of legal appeals that there are to prevent this happening. Their big hope is that if they can get a few refugees on a plane to Rwanda, it will act as a deterrent. People will stop coming here. I still doubt that very much indeed, as do many people who know a lot more about migration than I do.
Ben, it's an eternal question, I think, about immigration, not just in this country, but in all countries to whom migrants are drawn. And in this country, I think, you know, people often characterise it harshly for some of its attitudes towards immigration. But I do, trying to be charitable, wonder if what people get upset about is not the immigration or the immigrants themselves, it is the appearance of disorder and the appearance of chaos, and that there's no rule, there's no structure, nobody's watching the shop. And the thing I always come back to thinking about is that within the last few years, while there has been this record immigration, which is causing no end of political uproar, upwards of 100,000 overseas passport holders, British overseas passport holders from Hong Kong, a very visible minority, have moved to the United Kingdom. Nobody cares. It's not an issue at all, because I think people understand, well, okay, that makes sense. There's a structure, there's a regime, there are rules to this.
Yeah, it's the disorder, and I think that's why they focus on the boats rather than the legal migration, the huge numbers of that. It's a much more visible thing. It's a thing that people can get really angry about. But people are also angry about systems being exploited and the country sort of being taken for fools. Now, this week we had that huge story about the asylum seeker who was involved in the acid attack, mm-hmm. And the debate over how he converted to Christianity, or so the mm-hmm. priest had said, and that was why he stayed, and that is actually a huge thing that happens. It's a route that people get for passing the asylum judge system, and people feel that's unfair, and they feel like they're being exploited, that our hospitality is being exploited. So I think it's that, as well as the disorder, that people kind of just want this done properly, orderly and fairly.
But Carol, we have already a sense that, inexplicably, ahead of local and eventually general elections, the Tories are going to contrive to blame the Labour Party, who are, to be clear, in opposition for all of this. They have recently released some entrancingly deranged attack ads. Here is a clip from one of them.
A 54% increase in knife crime since the Labour mayor seized power has the metropolis teetering on the brink of chaos. And in the chaos, people seek a desperate reprieve.
Yeah, we are teetering on the brink of chaos, apparently, Carol. I've no idea what is going on with the accent there. I'm not quite sure how you end up characterising Sadiq Khan's victories in two elections as seizing power. But this is mad. I mean, who are they hoping to attract with this?
Well, it does seem to be very strange, as the party that's been in power for the last 15 years, to say, look, our capital city is this dystopian vision.
The party whose Home Secretary does have ultimate operational control over the Metropolitan Police, for example.
It is a quite extraordinary attack ad. What was even more extraordinary about it, Andrew, is that in this, when you see the footage of it, is this grainy, black and white, Gotham City type vision. But then you learn that actually the pictures of very anxious people running somewhere was actually shot in New York, mm-hmm. rather than London. So they did have to withdraw that one.
That might explain the accent, in fairness.
But they brought out a similar ad with a similar voiceover with the same American accent to talk about what's happening in Birmingham, the UK's second biggest city, which has a
teetering on the brink of chaos as well?
It is also teetering on the brink of financial chaos, as well as everything else. The idea that you can scare people into voting against your local authorities when you've been running the country nationally, I think, is a very, very strange one. I do wonder what the private polling was that suggested to them that this was a good idea. One thing that I can predict is I don't think it's going to protect the Conservatives from an absolutely dreadful set of results when we come to the local elections for local councils. councils and for mayors on May the 2nd, which will be seen as a very important indicator of public opinion if we hadn't already had a big run of opinion polls suggesting that the Tories are about 20 points behind their Labour opponents.
I mean, it is a bold strategy. We've been in power for 14 years. Everything's terrible. Vote for us. Before we move along, Ben, and another political development in broadly this vicinity, and this is being said in the absolute clear understanding that the United Kingdom and the Republic of Ireland are two entirely different countries. We understand that, and apologies if this sounds like we are shoehorning one into a discussion of the other. But while we have you here, Ben, Simon Harris, Ireland's new Taoiseach, following the surprise, genuinely surprise resignation to everybody, as far as I can tell, of Leo Varadkar. Basically, who is he? Will it make any particular noticeable difference to the way Ireland is governed and presents itself?
Well, to the last question, no. who is he? He's 37. He's very much a career politician. He's been in the cabinet for many years. He had the health ministry during the COVID pandemic. He's big on TikTok, or at least he likes to think he is, which lends itself to the phrase TikTok Taoiseach.
TikTok Taoiseach. I've seen people trying to make that a thing. Yep.
He is, I think not, he's a family man. He's very approachable, accessible because of the health thing, and a lot of people like him. They feel like he, oversaw a lot of, long waiting lists, etc. But look, ultimately, what you've got here is the current Irish government has to be out by the end of this year. Another election is due. It's a bit like the Conservatives here. They're not quite falling apart in the same way, but he will not be in power for any great deal of time. I don't think he's going to make much of a mark. We'll see what happens after that, really.
Well, let's move along to another country facing an election before the end of the year, which is the United States, where the former and possibly future President Donald Trump had a win of sorts earlier this week when a panel of appellate court judges reduced the surety he was due to stump up vis-a-vis his recent fraud case from $454 million to $175 million. $175 million is nevertheless a considerable sum, and at any rate, Trump may yet be on the hook for the full amount. He appears intent on clawing it back $59.99 a time, not including postage, by selling Bibles in cahoots with the dreadful country singer Lee Greenwood.
We've lost religion in our country. All Americans need a Bible in their home, and I have many. It's my favorite book. It's a lot of people's favorite book. This Bible is a reminder that the biggest thing we have to bring back America and to make America great again is our religion.
I'm not convinced myself, Carol, that Donald Trump is a regular churchgoer. Nevertheless, are you tempted by one of the Trump / Lee Greenwood God Bless the USA Bibles for $59.99?
I'm sure I'm going to be one of the minority of people who thinks that if I'm going to buy a new Bible, I don't necessarily want Donald Trump's writing all over it. But I think that it is fascinating. Obviously, this is just one of Donald Trump's money-raising merchandise ideas. You can get your gold trainers.
I'm wearing mine now.
$399, apparently.
Steal.
Yeah, I'm sure they're worth every penny. But it is astonishing the way that Donald Trump, despite everything that he's going through, just likes to portray himself as religious to his core. Of course, he does rely hugely on the evangelical vote. And I think what is absolutely fascinating is the way that the church and religion really runs through US politics in a way that it really doesn't here in the UK. And when I was in the United States recently, I actually spoke to Donald Trump's spiritual advisor, a preacher, Mark Burns, who talked to me about how Donald Trump really and truly is driven by his faith.
That's obvious nonsense.
Well, when I put it to him, when I questioned him as to how this deep religious faith went along with lying about
cheating
his
on your third wife with a porn star,
having to pay out millions of dollars for a sexual assault. I could go on.
We haven't got all night.
But when I tried to even raise these questions, it just didn't go down well. I mean, the preacher was pointing out that he was sure that I had sinned, which obviously I was happy to own up to. But I wasn't. That wasn't the point I was trying to make. But it is astonishing how Trump, Biden as well, God bless America, at the end of every big political speech that we see, this is just the way that US politicians approach that role in life. And it is such a huge difference to here in the UK, where people are very, very reluctant indeed to talk about their faith.
I mean, it strikes me that the UK has that much in common with Australia as well. We have had senior politicians and indeed prime ministers, one thinks recently of Scott Morrison and Kevin Rudd, who were very devout people, Ben, but tended to keep it under their hats. And I think, I mean, obviously risible though this thing of Trump's is, like everything Trump does. Nevertheless, there is a non-zero chance that he will be re-elected president this year, whereas in almost any other Western democracy I can think of, if a major party leader started talking like that, they would send for the men with butterfly nets.
Yeah, well, it's just a big part of what divides us, isn't it? It reminds me of that John Sopel book about his time in America that he wrote. He called it, if they didn't speak English, we'd think of them as being foreigners, or being very different culturally. You know, it is hugely different. You just have to really pay lip service to it. I mean, I did see a poll last month that showed that some evangelicals were moving towards Biden, which was interesting. I think some people may have thought, you know what, this guy is, I've really had enough with him. But I think ultimately religious people will still flock to him because they want someone who's going to protect the Constitution, put some more conservative judges on the Supreme Court, all those things that he actually delivered for them. You know, they got Roe v. Wade overturned. That sort of thing is why he pays lip service to those people. He tells them what they want to hear, and then they give him his vote. I mean, it's hilarious. There was that interview where he was asked, what's your favourite passage in the Bible? And he said, it's far too personal. I couldn't share that kind of thing. You know, it's...
That is a glorious clip, which I do enjoin our listeners to look up, or indeed tune in tomorrow for this week's What We Learned monologue, which, at the risk of giving away the punchline, does involve that exact clip. Carol, I started out by asking, were you tempted at $59.99? What if postage was free?
Look, I think that the other thing is that in this country, we would be absolutely outraged at someone trying to monetize their religion and their religious beliefs. And if there was a politician running for office trying to do that, I think there would be real howls of outrage at that. I think that our approach to it is just so different. Ever since, of course, Alistair Campbell famously, mm-hmm. when Tony Blair was asked about his faith, and he was
indeed
a political leader who did have a very deep faith, we don't do religion. And he stepped in to make sure that Tony Blair didn't talk about it, although he did it. He was at one stage, I think, asked if he actually prayed with President Bush. But it was seen as something that you simply couldn't do, that you didn't want to put out that message to the electorate. And I think that this idea of actually selling signed Bibles in Britain, I think we just don't approach our religion in that way.
Well, mercifully not. Just finally on this one, Ben, there is also, and again, you can do this stuff all day where Donald Trump's concerned, but the Book of Donald, this Bible, is being packaged with the founding documents of the United States, including Declaration of Independence, Constitution, Bill of Rights, and so forth. Now, given what we know about the views of the relationship between church and state held by the men who drafted those documents, this is going to provoke rumblings in the graves of Jefferson and Franklin, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's just messing the whole thing up, really. I mean, maybe he's sending people out, you know, what the Constitution looks like, so, you know, this is what it was before he was re-elected. You know, whatever it looks like on the other side is something else entirely.
Key detail as well, from which I will leave listeners to draw their own conclusions, the Bible's website page where you can order it, I have looked it up, specifies that it is in large print. Anyway, to Germany, where there are forbidding tidings for low-slung hounds and the people fond of them. Concerns have been raised that a draft law intended to clamp down on the deliberate perpetuation via breeding of certain canine characteristics could spell an end to the Dachshund, and indeed to the pug, the boxer, the English and French bulldog, toy poodle and cocker spaniel. The aim is to phase out those traits which can cause suffering to the dogs endowed with them. Dachshunds in particular, due to their extremely weird shape, are prone to spinal difficulties. Carol, first of all, we should specify that the Agricultural Ministry in Germany specifies everybody's getting a little bit carried away here. They're not trying to phase out any of these breeds. They're merely strengthening the existing ban on what is called torture breeding, which is exactly that, that you deliberately breed dogs burdened with things which will cause them suffering. That's not an unreasonable thing to want to do, is it?
No, but, you know, let's save the sausage dog. I mean, you know, come on, let's cut to the chase here. No, I think this idea of, I'd never heard of that phrase before, of torture breeding, but this idea of extreme breeding where you try very hard to accentuate certain characteristics of a breed does seem to me weird and bordering on the cruel, especially when you come to, for example, breeds like pugs and mm-hmm. bulldogs, where it, you know, they breed them for the flat face, but then the poor dogs have even more difficulty breathing than they usually do. Look, I mean, tougher restrictions on the techniques that are used to breed particular characteristics into a dog. I don't even know how they manage that. Proper safeguards against that. Yeah, absolutely. But the idea that, you know, because sausage dogs have rather long bodies and short legs, that we shouldn't have them anymore. I mean, come on.
Ben, would you like to take a position on the eradication of Dachshunds?
I think let them live. You know, I'm all for that. I don't want to see any dogs wiped out.
And who dare appear on a radio station in the UK and say anything different, let's face it.
I know. They're cute. They're sweet. As long as they're not in any pain. But I know that sometimes they are.
So, but that being the case, is it therefore not kind not to have any more of them?
I mean,
this has plunged the show into a fog of existential despair.
But these are ethical questions that probably go way beyond we mere talking heads. But it is something to think about. I do feel worse for the pugs. I feel, you know, that you can hear them sometimes struggling to breathe. I do often feel that quite keenly. You never are really aware that a Dachshund is struggling, maybe to keep up. But
To conclude then on a vaguely upbeat note, I will give you each one vote. Carol, what is the best dog? Pick a breed.
Well, as until recently, the proud owner of an absolutely beautiful English cocker who died just over a year ago now.
I am sorry to hear that. They are nice dogs if I may say so, not overburdened with intellect.
Oh, no, no. How can you say such a thing?
I had one as well, and he was dumb.
Oh, no. If I'm honest, he, you know, maybe intellectual ability wasn't his great strength, but loyalty, love, warmth, affection, the sweetest nature. And yeah, I'm choking up just thinking about him because we still really miss him. And I think Cocker Spaniels are the most beautiful of little dogs. And yeah, we're still weighing up. Every time I see, especially when I see a little puppy, you know, and we're tempted to get another one.
You missed one here at Midori House by about an hour. There was one in the building earlier. Just finally, what was your spaniel's name?
Luca.
Luca. Good name. Good name for a dog. Ben, are you going to pick the spaniel as well?
Go on then. Yeah, mine was called Woody. His trait was eating everything in sight, whether it was food or not. We had to give him away. He actually went to a farm, which is true. I was 17 when they told me that. But yeah, let's not dwell on it too much. They're cute.
We will dedicate this show retrospectively to Luca and Woody. Carol Walker and Ben Kelly, thank you both for joining us. Finally, it is time for our weekly Letter From series. And today, Monocle contributor Vincent McAvaney sends us a letter from the not-so-snowy French Alps.
At this time of year, it's easy to spot the late-season skiers at Europe's airports, travelling in their already unseasonably thick coats, carrying boots and helmets, in the hope of reaching milder, sunny resorts, still with enough powder covering their runs. But booking ski trips in the once reliable Alps is becoming an increasingly risky bet. When I was 17, I remember being given a blind text to discuss in my final set of French oral exams. It was an article from Le Monde newspaper declaring that France's ski resorts could potentially be unviable as soon as the early 2030s, thanks to global warming, as it was then more commonly referred to. In 2006, this felt like a long way off. Plenty of time to enjoy these resorts on the assumption a consensus on climate change was surely soon to be reached and the problem tackled. The problems even then seemed to be becoming clear, the impact on populations so perilous, and if nothing else, the opportunities for industrial innovation so great, it would be solved swiftly. Thankfully, the exam wasn't assessed on my naivety that conjugating solutions would be so simple. Here in 2024, at the world's biggest resort, Les Trois Vallées, the alpine collective of Mirabel, Courchevel and Val Thorens, it's abundantly clear now climate change isn't something we need to talk about in the future tense anymore. By mid-March, mountainsides usually covered in pristine white snow are pockmarked with earthy brown freckles. Trees, normally frosted and sagging, are green and upstanding. Accommodation built as ski-in, ski-out can no longer be marketed as such. The Trois Vallées, which played host to the 1992 Winter Olympics, is a spectacle of entrepreneurial imagination and engineering might, supporting thousands of jobs across this region. Boasting 156 lifts, 339 downhill tracks, hundreds of chalets, dozens of hotels, over its 600-kilometre network, the area promises to open for skiing a full 5 months of the year. But the usual December to April season is under threat, despite the hundreds of snowmaking cannons built to underwrite that guarantee. Talking to hospitality workers and ski instructors about recent seasons, they highlight the impact of the pandemic closures, the exiting of high-spending Russians due to sanctions, but it's clear the evident unpredictability of the climate is something they now know in their hearts could end their once stable livelihoods. 2023 was Europe's second warmest winter on record, dampening snow tourism. Meteorologists predict 2024 will be the hottest year on record. Riding on balmy ski lifts, you can see runs turned into mud pits already abandoned for the year. On the pillars upholding the cables, there are messages about how the resorts are tackling their own carbon footprints. Responsible, yes, but futile in protecting the traditional winter climate, which has shaped their traditional way of life and livelihoods. The Trois Vallées are currently bidding to host the 2030 Winter Olympics. Whether they will still have the required levels of snow is a genuine concern, as is the viability for the event, with a diminishing number of countries enjoying the climate to engage in these frosty pursuits. It feels like that article was right in its predictions. Ultimately, without global efforts to tackle climate change, Europe's peaks, with their decreasing glaciers and snow caps, are set to act as billboards high above the continent. Whether enough people look up to notice is another matter.
That was Vincent Macavany's letter from the French Alps, and that is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Carol Walker and Ben Kelly. The show was produced by Chris Chermack and researched by George Ruskin. Our sound engineer was Lily Austin. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.